From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
We live in a culture that privileges romance, and specifically marriage. It's not just that the fairy tales we grow up with end in some couple's happily ever after. The reign of romance is in our laws, too. In America, married people get over 1,000 legal benefits that single people can't access. And that's weird. I mean, we have other relationships, family, mentors, or friends. Why should society assume that romantic love is the ultimate form of commitment? For some people, even some married people, the most meaningful and long-lasting relationship is a deep, deep friendship. What if society were structured so that people with that kind of platonic partnership could raise kids together, share health insurance with each other, make medical decisions for one another, rather than being dismissed as just friends? I'm Sigal Samuel, and this is The Gray Area. My guest today is Raina Cohen. She's the author of the new national bestseller, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Oh, and she's also my friend. So this won't be your typical author interview. We'll dive into the core argument of Raina's book, that we're undermining romantic relationships by expecting too much of them, while diminishing friendships by expecting too little of them. Also, we're not going to shy away from the fact that Raina and I are friends. We're going to use our own friendship as a laboratory for exploring and challenging some of these ideas. Welcome to the show, Raina.
I'm obviously excited to get to have a conversation with you and call it work.
I want to just start with the fact that, at least from my perspective, a major project of your book is to take these ideas that we're all familiar with, friendship, romance, marriage, and historicize them. And by that, I mean, you try to show readers that these ideas have actually changed a lot over the centuries. So it's not like they just fell from the heavens in their current form. Tell me some of the surprising things that the historical record has revealed to you about friendship.
You know, I guess we could start in the present, which is we think about friendship now as a relationship that is kind of an add-on, not necessarily the crux of a good life, and a relationship that is private rather than one that is publicly recognized or celebrated. And it's a relationship that's lower on the hierarchy than family, than romantic relationships, even career. So that's where we are now. And then if you look back in time, the picture is actually really different. You know, you can go back to the story of David and Jonathan in the Hebrew Bible. You can go back to ancient Roman thinkers and how they talked about their friends as the other half of my soul or the better half of my soul. The kind of language that would seem more like what you would say for your romantic partner who is supposed to be at the top of your hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And there were practices in the past, like a ritual called sworn brotherhood, mm-hmm. where men would walk into a church, put their hands one on top of the other on the gospels, and have a priest say a blessing over them that made them committed to each other for life. And sometimes these men were buried with each other rather than with their wives when they were married. So it's making friendship public. There's a ceremony around it. It's making it equal to, if not greater than, marriage. It's turning friendship into an enduring kinship relationship. There is this emotional experience and adoration and effusion that we don't necessarily think of as appropriate in friendship right now.
Are you referring to the thing that you call in your book brotherment, or to use the original French term, affrèrement?
You're just showing off that you're Quebecois.
Tell me what I would find if I were to walk into Merton College's chapel in Oxford, England.
So if you were to walk into this chapel, you would see on the ground a monument that is to two men named John Bloxham and John Witten, who were friends from the record that we know in the 14th century, and were both affiliated with the college, and they had arranged to be buried together in their death. And they appear to have had this kind of sworn brotherhood relationship, which was something that you could see throughout medieval England, and you could find in the Byzantine Empire. You can find versions of this sworn brotherhood practice among monks in other parts of the world, like China. And you would see an ode to these two men, and it includes imagery of the two of them with these draping garbs that looks like they're saints.
Fast forward to modern day America, and we see an extremely sharp contrast. So how did we get to this kind of thinner, more impoverished view of friendship that we have today?
There are basically two trends that braid together. One has to do with the way that marriage has been understood over time, and the other has to do with what's possible within friendship. So marriage used to be much more of a pragmatic institution. People would enter into it really to merge their families and to merge their wealth and support each other in building families, and not so much for love, let alone finding a soulmate. And there, of course, was tons of inequality if you're looking at marriages between men and women, where women, until kind of recently, were property of their husbands. So it really is not much of a surprise then that people tended to find much more emotional intimacy in their same-sex friendships, which were more egalitarian, than in their marriages. But, you know, starting 150 years ago or so, it's much more common then for love to be seen as an essential part of marriage. And then in the last, like, half century, you have even higher expectations of marriage, where people want their spouse to be their best friend, which doesn't leave as much room for mm-hmm. friendship. So that's the kind of marriage trajectory. And then kind of alongside this, friendship is starting in this really high place where it is revered. You know, you have, you know, ancient thinkers saying that they could think of nothing better in life than friendship. And by the turn of the 20th century or so, the kind of innocence around emotional and even physical intimacy between same-sex friends became suspect, as you have the introduction of the categories of homosexuality and heterosexuality, and any kind of same-sex sexual interaction being seen as really stigmatized. So you don't get to have this kind of closeness where women were exchanging locks of hair with their friends, where same-sex friends were writing letters about, you know, how much they loved the other person, where they would share beds together because that was a norm at the time. There was really this kind of crowding out of the emotional and physical intimacy in friendship. People might not realize, like, the way that we think about someone's sexual orientation has not always been the way that it is now. Mm. In the past, like, you could have even some kind of sexual interactions and not necessarily be marked as a certain kind of person. And I think of it as the difference between saying you live in New York and that you're a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. Like, one is describing a behavior, which may or may not be stigmatized, kind of depending on the, you know, various circumstances in a society. And the other, that's really describing the essence of a person. And there was just a lot of fear around being labeled as a homosexual.
In the book, when you talk about friendship versus romance and love versus lust, you get into the neurobiology a bit, and you talk about, you know, this feeling is associated with that chemical, this feeling is associated with that other chemical. tell me a little bit about what the science reveals about the difference between friendship and romance, or love and lust.
I think most people today, in a place like the U.S., assume that these two things go together, that love is impossible to have without lust. So many of the friends that I write about in this book who clearly love each other are kind of incomprehensible to the world around them because everybody wants to imagine that they must have some kind of sexual desire for one another. But in fact, you know, there's research that shows that the drive for love, or what, you know, maybe in a more clinical term would be called an attachment relationship, is different from the sex drive. And while they might go together, they don't always. So different chemicals and networks in the brain that are involved in the attachment versus the sex drive. So hormones like androgens and estrogens that are involved in sex, whereas when you're forming a close attachment or love relationship, we're getting, you know, a hit of oxytocin and dopamine, those sort of feel-good chemicals that I think are familiar to a lot of us. And one of the ways that this is significant is it kind of helps explain how it is possible to feel passion and infatuation, which, you know, you might connect to an attachment relationship or a love relationship without having that sexual drive. And the researcher who's done a lot of this work is Lisa Diamond, who's at the University of Utah. And it helped her understand a bunch of women who she had interviewed and traced over the course of decades, who had a friendship that she talks about as a kind of in-between world, where they did not seem to be denying any kind of sexual desire that they had for another person. They just didn't feel it. And yet they had kind of more intensity than we think of as being reasonable in just, air quotes, a friendship.
So when I think about, like, what are the implications of the neurobiology for sort of how we're living, I sort of started to have the image in my mind of, like, Lego blocks. And I was wondering if we should think of different relationships as sort of structures made of these Lego blocks that we can, like, assemble, disassemble, reassemble into different configurations over time as our needs shift. Because at one point, you know, someone might be like your housemate and your sexual partner and your co-parent and your closest supporter in times of crisis. And at another point in life, like, maybe that's not the right fit. And they might be just one or two of those things. And maybe that kind of makes sense if a different neurochemical thing is happening at a different point. Maybe we should have more okayness about that sort of shift.
I think a familiar version of this for a lot of people is imagining maybe a very stereotypical romantic relationship over the course of decades, mm-hmm. that, you know, it starts off with sex being really an important part of it, and then people have kids and they don't really have time or energy to have much of a sexual relationship, and that may or may not be an issue for the couple. They might be feel sort of mutually about that. And we have a stereotype in our society that, like, older people are not that sexual, which I don't subscribe to, but there's some understanding that a marriage can still be really meaningful even if it becomes more companionate over time, and that it's built more on emotional intimacy and the sex piece is less important. So there's already recognition that you can have that kind of modularity in marriages. And I think this can apply to other kinds of relationships too. I mean, I think, you know, maybe the thing here is, like, actually recognizing, putting words to, talking about the way things change rather than just having them happen to us.
When we get back from the break, Raina and I use our own friendships to further explore the unsung role they play in our lives. Stay with us.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, Download the app or visit wise.com. That's wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him, the sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks.
Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This podcast is supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Choiceology is a show all about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Each episode shares the latest research on behavioral science and dives into questions like, can we learn to make smarter decisions? And what is the power of negative thinking? The show is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's an award-winning behavioral scientist, professor at the Wharton School, and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. In each episode, Katie talks to authors, athletes, Nobel laureates, and more about why we make irrational choices and how we can make better ones. Choiceology is out now. Listen and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or find it wherever you listen.
Bit of a confession to make. I don't know how much I told you about this at the time, Raina, but around a year ago, my partner and I were looking for a new place to move into together, and that was really exciting, but it also meant moving farther away from you. And, you know, we haven't known each other super, super long. We've maybe known each other around 3 years, but you somehow managed to like worm your way into my heart in a really beautiful way in that relatively short time. We would communicate a fair bit by voice memo, and that was really meaningful to me at a kind of hard time in my life where I was going back and forth to my hometown to help out with my dad in the final year of his life, and it was kind of isolating, and it was like really lovely to just occasionally be able to like receive a voice memo from a relatively new friend. It created the sense of closeness, and we kind of developed this habit of meeting at the halfway point between our houses, which was Colorama Park. So when it came time for me and my partner to move in together and find a place, I had this feeling like, you know what, staying near Colorama Park, my hangout spot with Raina, actually feels like surprisingly important to me. And I felt almost sheepish about that. Like I was almost a little embarrassed. Like, why does this feel important to me? That's not the social script. But I also felt sheepish about even like looking at apartments that were far away from you. Like I felt like I was cheating on you in some sense or cheating on the friendship. So I'm kind of curious to sort of ask you in a broader way, like, how do you think about navigating those tensions?
Oh, I miss our walks and the spontaneity that it allowed.
Yeah.
But I was also aware that it would be a loss for you to not live close by. I sent you listings. I think I was scouting for you in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
My main recommendation would be to do the thing that you found so impossible to do, which was acknowledge that the friendship mattered enough that it was a factor that was on the table. And to some degree, I think there was an acknowledgement between us that I really wanted you to be close by because I knew that if the radius gets too broad or the distance gets too large, like we just wouldn't be able to be easy parts of each other's lives in the same way. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of people, they couldn't admit that or they might not realize it. Like people are following a trellis where they are told, if you're a real successful adult, you either move in with a partner or you live alone. Mm-hmm. And they glorify the parts of it that can be really great, like having your fancy West Elm furniture and you have a backyard and having privacy or control and aren't necessarily thinking about the things that they're giving up for those benefits. And I think that we're always gaining and losing things depending on our decision. And it would help to have friendship be part of that calculus. You know, what kinds of decisions are you trading off closeness to friends, that maybe for you, the things that matter most, that are most essential to your life, are not the things that other people have said. Or maybe they've matched perfectly, but it's like worth asking the question. No matter what, there are going to be things that you have to give up.
You know, the reality is there are trade-offs. There's always trade-offs going on. And, you know, there's trade-offs even just if you're two people, if you're just a couple. This one wants to live near their family. This one wants to live near their friends, whatever it might be. And if you add more people into that picture, that can compound the complexities. And I know that you're no stranger to this, Raina. Like, you have a spouse. You have these very, very deep friendships. You also live with a couple of friends and their two kids. Is there any other sort of concrete advice you would want to give people, or you would have wanted to give me, about like how to try to make it all work?
You know, I think mentality-wise, that could be helpful is unbundling so many of the things that we attach to romantic relationships. So the expectation is like, well, of course you're going to live with your romantic partner, and only your romantic partner, not anybody else, like in the kind of arrangement that I have. Of course your romantic partner is going to be the first person that you call when something wonderful or terrible happens. They are going to be your plus one to weddings and to, you know, any family event, and so on. And, you know, one of the things that I saw in people in the book who have these friendships that look like romantic relationships minus the sex is that they are unbundling other things, not just taking out the sex piece. One example would be with these two women who have been raising a kid together for 14 years and are legal co-parents to this child. They don't live in the same home. They live in different units in the same condo building, and they call each other vertical neighbors.
I love that.
Yeah, and they said that it would not be compatible for them to live together because one is very messy and one is very neat. And I don't think that romantic partners tend to think of it that way, that it's possible that you could have so many great pieces, but you don't coexist well in physical space, you know, on a day-to-day level. And maybe you should live in separate units right next to each other or have separate bedrooms. And if you still want to share a space with somebody, or it's really important to have a sense of who your confidant is or options for a plus one, then friends might be on the table and they can enter into roles that had previously been fenced off from them.
Do you think your partner, your romantic partner, your spouse has ever felt bummed that, you know, maybe a friend is sort of claiming some of that territory that conventionally might go to the spouse?
That would seem intuitive, but it really has not been the case at all. I think part of it is probably temperamental, that my husband is an extremely non-jealous person. He also is like one of the most well-adjusted people I know. I don't think he's the kind of person who reacts with envy very often. I think that he saw it as additive, that I have this extremely close friend who in many ways was kind of co-equal to him for a couple years, especially when he and I were long distance and my friend and I were a 5-minute walk from each other and really more integrated into each other's day-to-day lives, that he has an independent relationship with her. A lot of our shared friends, we have independent friendships with. I just think it's always been something that we've been drawn to. Like in our ketubah, which is a Jewish marriage contract, we did a kind of non-traditional thing, which was write our own marriage contract. And one of the things we put in there was be individuals together. We also put in that we wanted to encourage relationships with other people in our lives, friends, coworkers, and so on. So I think it's just so part of how we understand what a good romantic relationship looks like, that jealousy is in many ways the kind of opposite impulse to how we have set up our values.
I am curious about, like, what's your feeling about quantity versus quality of friends? Is there ever an argument for pruning the friendship tree, if you will, so that you can, you know, in the name of then having like deeper connection with whoever you really want to have that with?
I have this conflict every time my birthday comes around and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do for my party. I feel kind of conflicted about this as somebody who really enjoys being surrounded by people who are different from me, but also thrives in intimate conversation or feeling really known and like I can kind of express all parts of myself. You know, people are going to have different desires over quantity and quality, maybe at different points in your life. I mean, there's been also research on this that older people do tend to have fewer friends because they are pruning. They're sort of deciding who's more important to them. But I think there are a lot of advantages to getting to know new people and mixing around, like who is playing a bigger or smaller role in your life as a friend.
This is interesting because, you know, I feel like there's this critique of, oh, society has this very sort of individualistic focus on the marriage, right? It's a marriage between two people. Potentially, at least from like a, if they take a cursory glance through your book, someone might argue, oh, there's still an individualist focus in your book. It's like the book focuses on one-on-one relationships, only here it's not romantic partners, it's like a pair of friends. Some of the dissatisfactions that you identify within marriage could be potentially improved by having a few more close friends that we can lean on, dump on, you know, take pressure off the marriage or the romantic partnership. But like some feelings of unhappiness might have to do with people not feeling embedded in wider networks of community, like especially for those people who want like the 600 tea dates with different people or like, you know, they want that quantity of people. What is the role for community in your view?
This is something I thought a lot about because I didn't want to tell people like, here are the problems with how much we ask of romantic partners. Now just ask the same things of friends.
Yeah.
There's a real analytical purpose to me of presenting these sorts of friendships, which are so intimate and devoted that they look a lot like romantic relationships. And yet there are these differences, like they are societally invisible. There's no name for them. Instead of venerating them, there's a lot of suspicion. So I thought they were really valuable for the kind of comparison that they would allow us to make to romantic relationships. And I think we can see all sorts of things we take for granted about romantic relationships, family, friendship. What is even romance, for instance, and commitment? So there is a real purpose in looking at these particular kinds of friends, even though they, at first glance, really do resemble romantic relationships. So I don't think that having one person, whether it is a friend or a romantic partner, is really enough for most people. Mm-hmm. And that having a wider set of friends and then beyond that, a community where you can walk into a space and not necessarily know everybody, but feel like you could ask for things of them or you could talk to them. Mm-hmm. I think people need that in addition to the individual close relationships.
It's interesting because I think your inspiration for writing this book came from one very deep, intense friendship in your own life. I'm wondering if you can tell me about that friendship, how it started, how it changed over time, and how you feel about that now.
Yeah, when I think about when I first met the person I call M in the book, it really felt like I fell for her, where I met her at a party, spotted her across the room, felt kind of like magnetically drawn to her. We clicked, we realized that we lived a 5-minute walk from each other and spent a ton of time together. It got to a point where both of us were kind of like, I don't know that best friend is really the right term to describe who we are to each other. That like best friend feels kind of juvenile. It doesn't seem like it captures the sense of like excitement and commitment and sense of a future in a way that we were thinking about together. So very much in this like beautiful honeymoon for a couple years, and then Em moved to the UK for grad school, which we both knew was going to change things on some level, but it changed things more than I had anticipated and was hard for me to figure out how to even talk about what had changed. And eventually we basically got to a place where I had to understand that like we were not going to go backwards. We were not going to go to a place where we were as integral to each other's lives as we once were for various reasons. But the lack of language for transitions in friendship and also the kind of lack of understanding of what the heights of this friendship look like made it really hard for me to talk to anybody about it because I was like, I don't know if nobody's ever experienced this, like what does it mean for them to have it downgraded from a platonic partnership to best friend? Like how would people understand that? And for me, part of the loss was like we had constructed a kind of relationship that felt so particular to us and so special. And I had lost that kind of relationship and how important she was in my day-to-day life. So
it's not just replaceable with some other random person.
You know, it felt like that would be a betrayal or like missing the point that part of what was beautiful was what we had created that was specific to us, that was not following the relationship escalator, as it's called in romantic relationships, where you're just kind of like pulled along. Mm-hmm. We had kind of made something.
Yeah.
I write about this. This is like the point in my, when I recorded the audiobook where I got choked up thinking about this time. Mm. You know, I will say Em and I remain very close. I think we needed to work through that transition. And one of the things that's happened is now there's a third friend who we both had independent friendships with. And now it's kind of a trio. more often than not. And that has been a really special kind of friendship that I had not known to want before. And in some ways, like, mimics the experience of, like, I have fallen into a dynamic that nobody told me that I should pursue or could pursue or what it would feel like, and how special that is. So I'm trying to embrace both kind of more upfront conversations and fighting for friendships, not letting them fall away, but also recognizing that there are ways that they can evolve unexpectedly, but still remain really significant, just maybe different than you had expected.
Yeah. And I mean, the way that you talk about it, I think you called it a loss, and there's really like a sense of grief there. And what's harder is, like, it's a kind of disenfranchised grief. It's a kind of grief that is, like, invisible or unscrutable to a lot of people because they didn't understand what this kind of platonic partnership or deep, deep friendship was to begin with. I don't know. I have to say, like, I feel somewhat familiar with that sense of grief in relation to my own, you know, best friend from childhood. We've been best friends since we were, I think, 11.
My thought is, like, what a lucky girl that, like, your friend was, that she got to be best friends with you.
I mean, I was a pretty fun, nerdy, I don't know, same thing, 11-year-old, because the way we became friends was like exchanging books like The Hobbit and Agatha Christie. So
some things don't change, Seagal.
I know. It was a vibe. It's still my vibe. But like, now I feel really pretty sad when I think about it, because this is someone who really felt like family to me. And, you know, you have this term in the book being an invariable in someone's life. And I really felt like I was an invariable in her life. She was an invariable in my life. And I just sort of assumed it would feel that way forever. You know, now she lives elsewhere. There's an ocean between us. She has a kid. It's a different time in life. And we're really not close. I'm still struggling to figure out how to deal with that and whether I want to do something to try to change that, what I could do. I don't know, not to turn you into like my friendship guru, but kind of turning you into my friendship guru. Do you have advice for people like me or you know, others who felt like they were an invariable in someone's life? There's some kind of drifting apart that happens. Is there some way to like access, I don't know if it's like compassion or understanding for what the other person might be going through or what it might be, but how would you advise us to try to navigate this?
Have either of you talked at all about this, like broached the subject?
Yes, that's what is really hard for me, is that we have talked about it and I feel like I've repeatedly sort of made bids for like, let's be closer, let's try to like change something, and nothing changes.
I'm wondering what the context is for those conversations, because one thing I'm thinking that sometimes the tension and the longing can take up so much space in the dynamic in a friendship that what you also need to be able to restore is the joy and the laughter and the good parts and the connection.
Yeah.
Maybe a conversation like this is easier to have if you're like, look, I'm planning for us to have a getaway, or like, I'm going to come to you, even if it's for a day or something, mm-hmm. and we're going to have this great time together. Mm-hmm. And that will refresh the feelings that, at least in my experience, I can kind of forget in a way. Like, I intellectually remember how I feel with somebody, but can forget how great it is. And that when you have that reminder, and also you're in this space of pleasure, that it's easier to have those conversations.
To return to that idea of modularity, like, I'm kind of wondering, I don't know, maybe it would help if I could get my head around this idea of, instead of trying to like replicate exactly what we had when we were 11 or 21 or whatever it was, to maybe accept like, okay, that was a beautiful time. It's not going to be the same way forever. How can we turn the dimmer switch? How can we like move the Lego blocks around and adjust what the friendship looks like to suit different needs at a different time in life?
To your Lego blocks point, you're reminding me that I talk about it as a collage too. It's like shifting these pieces around. But I think that we need to hold two things at once, which is to not let friendships fall away because it is too hard to have conversations about this, which I think it's most likely that people are just like, yeah, friendships change. That's the natural course of things. Hold on, that you can really try to like do work, have hard conversations to prioritize a friendship. And on the other hand, practice a kind of, I guess, non-attachment. You know, I'm thinking about how I just spent several days in my college town. I'd been there in like 4 years, and the downtown, like my favorite coffee shop had closed. So much had changed. And yet like so much was also still the same. And I had to just like adjust a little bit to, this is a place that is home to me. It felt like a homecoming, but it is also not the same as it was. And I think that there's something similar to do with our friendships. And that I had to do with the friendship that I write about here, like to make peace with the idea that I couldn't return to the same exact place in our friendship and expect everything to be intact. But neither did I have to shun it or be so hurt that I didn't let it take a new shape that worked for the two of us.
I find that a really tough thing to accept, but I think I might try to do that.
I'm not telling you that this is easy. I just think this is maybe where I've found some kind of psychological peace. I think it's an easier out to be like all or nothing, basically. Like either I get this thing that I had and I want and I'm going to constantly be craving it and yearning for it, which I totally recognize, or I just let it go and I'm going to be like seething and angry or hurt about it. And I think there's a way to grieve what was. It's not simply that you tell yourself, well, like I have to move on. I think it is making space for what the loss is, which we don't do in friendship. There's one person who asked me a question about loss and like her eyes were welling up.
Yeah.
There was so much unacknowledged pain that people have felt because there's more than one layer of loss that happens with friendship. It's like the loss of the relationship you had. And then also the sense that nobody recognizes it, that there's no support, that no one's going to treat it as seriously. You're not going to get a day off from work because you had a friend break up. And I think that going through the grieving process, asking others to support you and take seriously the grieving process might also make it easier to move to this phase where you're trying to figure out, okay, I'm going to try to make peace with this change and figure out what this new shape of our friendship can look like.
After one more short break, we talk about how laws could better reflect the key role that friends play in our lives. Stay with us.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries, not including...
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and this is Unlocking Us. In this podcast, we'll explore ideas, stories, experiences, research, books, films, music, anything that reflects the universal experiences of being human, from the bravest moments to our most brokenhearted moments. Some episodes will be conversations with the people who are teaching me, challenging me, confusing me, maybe ticking me off a little bit. And some days I'll just talk directly to you about what I'm learning and how it's changing the way I think and feel. The first episodes are out now. We're going to do 3 or 4 part series every quarter, so about 12 to 15 episodes a year. Unlocking Us will always drop on Wednesdays. And now you can find me wherever you normally listen to your podcasts. You can get new episodes as soon as they are published by following Unlocking Us on your favorite podcast app. And as always, stay awkward, brave, and kind.
Once upon a time in America, there was no such thing as all-you-can-eat shrimp. And then the world changed.
Today, shrimp is the most popular, the most consumed seafood in America.
the endless shrimp fiesta is an American institution.
But that shrimp fiesta comes at a steep price. Here at Gastropod, we found out that hidden behind the delicious shrimp on your plate is environmental disaster and modern-day slavery.
So can you have your shrimp and a clear conscience too? Actually, yes, and we've got the secret to help you unlock true, lifelong shrimp happiness. Listen to the latest episode of Gastropod wherever you get your podcasts.
There is this great term in your book, compulsory coupledom, which I take to be kind of talking about this sort of fixation in our society on romantic relationships and particularly on marriage. And that's not just a cultural thing. The government seems to really promote and push marriage. Can you just tell me a little bit about how that came to be historically? Like, why does the state want to be so up in my business and should it get out?
A lot of the kinds of rights and benefits that are attached to marriage and the entitlements you see really develop around the New Deal when there are these new government programs and a kind of good proxy to make sure that everyone is covered in a society where almost everybody is married is to use marriage as a criteria for something like dependency. So it's a way to like cover women for retirement benefits to make sure they're not in poverty when they themselves, at least white women, are probably not working. Basically, marriage is a shortcut to tell you something about caregiving and dependency and for the state to encourage, you know, people to have those sorts of relationships. Like we need people to be caring for each other.
That's also because it serves the state, right? That's like, yeah. That means fewer people on government roles, right?
Fewer people on government roles, but also like there is value to people raising children and there is value to people caring for somebody who is sick. It doesn't mean that you can't have other people do it, but it's a way of recognizing that it is important societally for that to happen, that that's not just free.
To this day in the US, marriage just comes with like this huge package of rights and benefits and friendships, no matter how deep or committed they are, get basically nothing. And to me, that seems pretty silly because functionally, these relationships, these deep friendships are often doing a lot of the same stuff, the stuff that the state wants to see happen. So this like caregiving, economic support. And I guess what this brings up for me is like, what would be the most effective way to grant unmarried people the same rights as married couples have? Like, do we need a legal alternative to marriage?
Well, I want to like pinpoint a word you use, which was function. And I think that so much of the law is built around the form or the structure of relationships and not paying as much attention to the function. And that there's been certainly in family law, a shift to look more at like, what is the function that an adult plays in, you know, a relationship with a child? You know, when you think about the way that people are having children now with the help of science, it has sort of forced the courts to look at the function of a relationship rather than just like, what is the gender of the couple? What is the marital status of the two people involved? And I think you can extrapolate that out beyond even the parenting relationships, but, you know, just to the relationships between adults to first, what is it that we care about that the state has a vested interest in? And you know, one of the arguments that I saw from several legal scholars is that it is caregiving and economic interdependence that the state has a vested interest in supporting. And then you can either controversially maybe adjust marriage so that there's sort of an inventory done where you're only keeping the rights and benefits that pertain to caregiving and economic interdependence. So one example that one legal scholar gave me was workers' compensation for a surviving spouse. It's like, well, why is the person getting that money from the state? Well, the point is that you're compensating for lost income in a relationship where people are economically interdependent. And it is possible to use that as criteria rather than marriage, because marriage is not, especially this day and age where so many people are not married and people have separate bank accounts and other sorts of things, like that is not as good of a proxy as it used to be. So you can basically strip marriage down. You can extend benefits on a different basis. And some, I think, simpler options are like, just have people designate a person who is the default stop for making major decisions in their lives. Could be something as simple as like a form that you fill out when you're at the DMV or at the post office. If you think about all of the people who are not married, either for their entire lives or for some phase of life, if they are at all. And then you have a huge crop of people who are not married after having been married because they are divorced, because they survived their spouse. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the astonishing statistics for me is that nearly half of women over 65 are unpartnered. That's a huge number of people. And that's for an older cohort where like a lot of people didn't get married. So it helps for those people or those stages of life to have someone they can go to. And then I think the final option would be the legal alternative to marriage that doesn't have the romantic connotation attached to it. And actually, I'm in Colorado right now, and Colorado has this law that legal scholars have said can be a template for elsewhere called a designated beneficiary agreement, and not a super sexy term. We could come up with something different maybe, but but what's really interesting about it is that it is different from marriage where you have this giant bundle that you were talking about with, you know, more than 1,000 rights and benefits, that it's a little bit more a la carte where there's two sheets of paper, very simple, 16 different rights and benefits, and you can check off which ones you want to give and receive from the other person. So that kind of template could be used in other places that would allow people in non-marital relationships to ensure that the person who is making medical decisions on their behalf is the one that they want, and the person who is handling end-of-life care is the person that they want, and to give some kind of status, not just the kind of tangible rights that would ensure that whoever they think of as this really significant person or significant persons could be seen as such.
I find that idea really, really appealing of making it more a la carte and being able to designate different rights to different people. And I actually think a lot of people would find that very appealing. I've been kind of pushing your book on a lot of my different friends, and people have been saying to me, this really resonates with me. This friend of mine, she has a partner. They're very serious. They're like trying to have kids together. But she was saying to me, like, I don't want him to be the one making my like medical decisions if I'm in the hospital one day. Like, I want that to be my friend so-and-so, like my closest friend who's like really my person on this kind of stuff. And so I actually think there would be like a huge appetite for that. And that appetite is sort of invisible now because people don't know to talk about this. They don't know this is like even a possibility.
The other thing is that it would seem almost like an insult if you did have a romantic partner, that someone worried about the state of your romantic relationship if you're like, my husband, I love for like these 70 reasons, but mm-hmm. he doesn't know how my body parts work mm-hmm. in the same way as like my female friend does. I'm thinking about a point in the book where this woman who had a very complex delivery, she had to get an emergency C-section. Her father was there to support her, and her father was like, he needed to be consoled by the doula, and it was her friend who was there to help. And even as this woman told me that, she was like, my father is a wonderful, wonderful man, but when his kids are in any kind of distress, he's not able to handle it. Mm-hmm. Not everybody is able to handle it. And it is okay for one person to not be the right person for everything. And like, I think from my vantage point, I'm very aware of my weaknesses and certain kinds of skills and that I'm not so great at. And it would be a relief to me in many ways to know that there might be another person for my husband to turn to for certain kinds of things that I'm not the best at. But I do think that that's so not in line with the kind of all-encompassing, monogamous, exclusive thinking that we have around what a romantic partner should be.
It seems like there are some different options. You know, we could theoretically open marriage up and give other people access to marriage, give other types of relationships, like deep friendships, access to marriage and sort of like subsume them under the category of marriage. I'm personally not so into that idea because we could just dismantle this structure whereby like marriage gets all the rights.
I do talk about friends who end up getting married because they think it makes sense for one reason or another, and there are complications mm-hmm. of trying that.
Yeah. So when you kind of look forward and you try to imagine in 10 years from now, in 20 years from now, what do you think is the likeliest route if policy is going to change to accommodate these different types of deep committed friendships that we do see on the ground and we see, for example, in your book, what do you think we're likely to see? What route do you think policy could potentially take that would actually work?
We both live in Washington, and I feel very skittish about doing any kind of policy prediction as a journalist and someone who's not in it. But I will say that there are already legal alternatives to marriage that are happening in the U.S., and there are groups that are really pushing for this. So in Somerville, Massachusetts, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, there are already these domestic partnerships that you can sign up for that actually allow more than two people to sign up. And they were really explicitly made so that they didn't have a romantic connotation for them, so friends could take advantage of them. And there's also the first legislation that would prevent discrimination on the basis of family structure. It was also passed in that part of the country. And on Valentine's Day this year, basically the same kind of legislation was introduced in Oakland and in Berkeley. So I already see people moving in this direction of trying to put other options on the table. And what I think is promising about the Colorado law is the balance that it has between customizability and ease and access. So, you know, right now, if you want to give rights to multiple people, like, you can go to a lawyer and draw up legal documents. It's just going to be really expensive. And then when the time comes in the hospital, you probably have to do some explaining and might not be immediately recognized, which is another thing that I've seen happen to people. The flip side is, like, you can take this, like, one-size-fits-all option of marriage, but that might not work for friends. So the Colorado law is interesting because it's very cheap. It's easy to get, but it also has at least some amount of customizability. It's not like prenup level customizability that you'd have to pay a ton of money for. So I think something that has that mix of, like, access and customizability could be helpful in the future. But let's talk in 20 years. We'll put it on the calendar.
Let's do a reprise of this episode in 20 years or 10 years. But honestly, it gives me hope to hear that these things are on the table and are being put into practice, at least in some places. I really, really hope that we start to see more of this kind of policy shift over the next few years. I think a lot of people would benefit from it. And I think the first step to getting there is probably just raising awareness that there is appetite for this. There are a lot of people who are already trying to live these kinds of lives. And I think the thing about your book is that it is really bringing these stories to light and is going to give, I think, a lot more people permission to see that this is a thing, to feel like they can talk about it, and then to feel like they can demand that their laws and policies reflect their actual needs. So thank you for writing a book that potentially can change things in a way that I think will genuinely be helpful for a lot of people. And thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for being my friend. did that sound not earnest enough? Because I really am so grateful.
It's okay. I know that you're deeply, deeply earnest. And I just want to say, Raina, you know how at the top of the episode, we started by talking about the brotherment, the people who did affrèrement.
Oh, are you going to propose a ceremony?
I think we should have rituals, not just for people who want to have brotherment, but do you know how to say sister in French?
Sir?
Yeah. So, you know, centuries ago, they had brotherment or affrèrement. Can we maybe have some ritual for sisterment or assœurment?
Assœurment. Yeah, thinking about how you, for my birthday, you were like, if we were to make a crest, like, what would be the symbols on our crest? And you, like, started sketching something. And then for my birthday, you gave me a crest for our friendship. To me, actually, that like, so spoke to the thing that adults don't do. I think kids do on some level, certainly girls in my experience, in my upbringing, that they are, like, commemorating and celebrating the friendship and treating it as this entity that you want to honor and, you know, try to cherish and show how it's unique, and that our crest does that.
Totally. Why should there only be family crests? Why not friendship crests? And why not sistermint rituals? I'm not saying we one day need to be, like, buried in a crypt together like those guys who had the brotherment thing going on, but, like, maybe we could at least take another spin around Colorama Park.
Oh, yeah. I'd like that.
This episode was produced by John Ahrens, edited by Jorge Just, engineered by Patrick Boyd. Alex Overington wrote our theme music. I want to hear from you. Tell me what you thought of this episode. Tell me what your best friend thought of this episode. Drop us a line at thegrayarea@vox.com. New episodes of The Gray Area drop on Mondays, so listen and subscribe. The Gray Area is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep Vox free by going to vox.com/give.